Good morning. This is Keep 106.
You are listening to Ridgeway Magazine with John Shepherd and Andy Fenton.
Just a little loving early in the morning beats a cup of coffee for starting off the day. Just a little loving when the world is yawning makes you wake up feeling good, things are coming your way.
Welcome. A policeman's lot in 2021 is not a happy one. We start with a hard-hitting interview with the outgoing Police and Crimes Commissioner, Martin Underhill. Does the public still trust the police? COVID has altered everything in regard to policing, he says. Still with COVID, we have an update on vaccination in our part of Dorset and ask why some people are hesitating to have the life-saving jab. Over to you, Andy.
Good news for pubs and restaurants with gardens. Dorset Council are bending over backwards to allow marquees and the like, temporary structures they call them, to enable food and drink to be served outdoors. Our good cause this week is the Hall and Woodhouse Community Chest, which has £50,000 to distribute to local charities. We ask about the future for Weymouth's 170 B&Bs and guest houses as summer approaches, and we talk to a proprietor. And for our gardening slot, Ruth talks about weeds and weeding. But first of all, an item that concerns us all. The police are literally getting a bashing, both physical and verbal, not least over enforcing COVID lockdown regulations and policing out-of-control protests in our cities. In a forthright interview, the outgoing Dorset Police and Crime Commissioner, Martin Underhill, suggests policing is at a crossroads. Is the public taking out its frustrations on the police? And what sort of police force does it want? He talks to John by phone.
It's amazing to think that we spoke a year ago this month on your planned retirement after 8 years as a local police and crime commissioner and also 30 years in the police service. And here we are still talking. You elected to stay on the extra year as a police and crimes commissioner. So how has it been, Martin?
Hi, John, and thanks for asking me into this interview. I've got to say it's been the most interesting of my 9 years as Police Crime Commissioner, for obvious reasons. The whole world went into a pandemic, which we've never done before. It's been challenging, really challenging, for everybody, and for me, to be fair. I didn't expect the extra year. I had everything teed up, ready to hand over to my successor. But, you know, we have to be grateful for small mercies. Lots of people have suffered terribly under COVID, and I can't complain. And it was actually, looking back on it, a real honour to lead the force with the Chief Constable in that year. It's brought lots of changes to policing that will always be here. COVID was a terrible thing, still is a terrible thing, and we've all know someone who's lost someone in Dorset. We've lost over 1,000 people in Dorset to COVID, including many, many in Dorset Hospital. But there have been some good things come out of COVID. Changes to the way we work, changes to the way we view life. Some are positive, some aren't. We'll talk later about the police deficit, as you call it, the lack of trust of the police caused by COVID, which is in itself really worrying. But we have seen some positive steps. So one of them actually is that when this all erupted a year ago, we very quickly had to change our battle rhythm as a society and as a police force. And the Chief Constable took over chairing the Local Resilience Forum. He then quickly set up a strategic coordination group, an SCG as we call it, which is all the operational leaders in Dorset, which is the army, the police, the ambulance service, the fire, the local authorities, no politicians at all. And they were there just to get on with the business and make Dorset a safe place in COVID. And then from falling out from that was what we called senior politicians. And I had never been called a senior politician before, but suddenly I found myself chairing meetings with the 8 MPs and the 2 local authority leaders and myself with the Chief Constable. basically being very fast and fleet of foot, dealing with the emerging trends, because we all forget that in the last year we've had 4 or 5 different stages of COVID. And who can forget last May, which was the third stage, where the doors were unlocked, the public ran to the beach, and we had 1 million people in Bournemouth, clogged traffic, beach closed, major incident declared, Lulworth Cove, awful case of the tombstoning, and 3,000 people on the beach when the helicopter flew in. We all saw that on the national news. That was just part of the story, part of the rich tapestry that we call COVID.
So you had possibly a choice between soft touch and hard touch policing. So I think in the first element, you decided on soft touch, didn't you?
Yes. So firstly, it is the Chief Constable's decision, obviously. But it was interesting in our senior politician meetings where we all agreed. I mean, and there were disagreements in that room over a year. There's no doubt about that. There have been instances where myself and the MPs have disagreed, or the local authorities and I have disagreed, or we've all disagreed about the way forward, particularly when we reopened the economy. There was definitely two sides of the argument. One was, you know, half of Dorset wanted to stay locked down and the other half wanted to open. So it was an interesting time. But going back to your point, the politicians all agreed with the police that actually in the initial 6 to 8 weeks, we would take a soft approach. And we did. And actually, as Police Crime Commissioner, I did a survey of the public in April to say, how do you think the police did? And that was really interesting. Over 70% of the respondents said they thought the police had used clear messaging and had acted with respect. I think 85% said they acted with respect. So it's quite clear that people at Dorset supported the soft approach. The police and the politicians in supporting them only changed to the tough approach when we got to May, June, when it was, you know, there's no other word for it, it was chaos. We were national news every day for the wrong reasons. Bournemouth Beach, the statues, don't forget the statues came in the middle of that. And suddenly we had Baden Powell statue and Black Lives Matter happening. So we weren't just policing Dorset for COVID. Suddenly Black Lives Matters and the statues came in. It was a busy time. And and we had to go from soft to hard and then back to soft. Well, that's what the police did. And that all feeds into, John, this police deficit. Because even before Sarah Everard, even before the events of the last month, policing took a huge dent because of COVID. And that's no one's fault. This is not a political debate. The government had to use the police to enforce the lockdown. Policing wasn't used to enforcing laws. Don't forget, and I'm sure you know, there have been over 60 different laws or guidelines on COVID in a year. And we're expecting police officers, 23 years old, earning £22,000-£23,000 a year to remember all those laws. You know, it's a difficult balance. This is not a political debate. It's the fact that police is by consent. The public normally want us to police them. As a politician, I know the public want the police to police them. And suddenly, the police were enforcing COVID regulations, particularly on people who came outside of Dorset into Dorset. And the statistics show that of the thousands of tickets issued, over 50% have been issued to non-residents of Dorset.
I think there was a number of 1,200 fines, wasn't there, that had been levied on people?
Yes, so well over 1,000. And about 600 or 700 of those were non-residents of Dorset. So that's the other balance the police had to achieve. You're trying to achieve safety when the whole population wants to go to the beach because it's beautiful weather and they've been locked down for 8 weeks. You're trying to achieve safety for the people of Dorset when 1 million people from outside Dorset arrive. And you're trying to be proportionate in the way you issue tickets. And unfortunately, well, or fortunately, whichever way you look at it, Dorset ended up being the third highest police force in the country for issuing tickets. But we were invaded, it's the wrong word, it sounds disrespectful, but we were swamped. We were swamped by millions, literally, of people, as was Devon and Cornwall. I mean, on one day in particular, I remember there were 700,000 people estimated to be on the beach at Bournemouth.
Good heavens.
I mean, that is just staggering. That is virtually the population of Dorset.
I think, do we know what people want the police to be? Because, I mean, policing, I think, is right to say, is at a crossroads at the moment. I mean, there's so much going on. For instance, you know, the COVID passport, there's the right to protest, Black Lives Matter, the businesses you pointed out, of statues, people boarding them up, or people graffitiing statues. I mean, there is an awful lot going on.
There is an awful lot going on. And I am sad, we didn't know this was going to happen, did we? But I'm sad to leave at the time I'm leaving, because I would say about 3 months ago, I wouldn't have said that. But I'm sad to be leaving at the moment, because the transition in a senior politician overseeing the police at the time where we really don't know what's happening every day. You know, Dorset police officers, as I speak, are in Bristol, because we're fearing another night of violence there tonight. These are really uncertain times, and it's very rare that society has four or five tectonic plates moving together at the same time, and that's what we've got. We've got the anti-COVID movement, we've got Black Lives Matter, we've got the Sarah Everard whole issue of safety for women and violence against women and girls. We've got the summer, and we've got a disaffected population, because about probably 25% of that population will lose their jobs over COVID at some stage. All of that leads to a really worried police crime commissioner, a really worried chief constable. This is a very worrying summer. I am, in my heart of hearts, I think we're going to face the civil unrest we faced in 2011-12.
In my newspaper today is full of COVID passports. I mean, having the knowledge that you have, do you think something like that would work, and how would it work?
No, it won't, because it's all very well saying you have to have a COVID passport to go for a drink or go to the theatre. It completely misses the point, John. There are people... and we don't know the figures, do we? But in my head, I would reckon 1 in 20 people after this lockdown, third or fourth lockdown, are now suffering from agoraphobia. There are many people I know who will not leave the house. They are so institutionalized because of the last year, particularly if they were told to shield by the NHS, which many were, that they don't want to go out. And that's why they're not going for a vaccination. That doesn't make them a bad person. It doesn't mean they shouldn't be able to engage in social activity once they get brave enough to leave their house. And the other reason I don't agree with the vaccination passport is we know the take-up of vaccinations is much lower in the black and ethnic minority groups for various reasons, some political, some religious, some lifestyle. And what you're doing is saying to people from the BAME community, you can't go to the pub, you can't go to the cinema because you haven't complied and had your jab. I think it's a really dangerous precedent. And, of course, who's going to pick up the pieces from that?
Well, exactly.
The police force is already in policing deficit. There's already facing enormous violence from all of the different conflicting agendas I've already mentioned. And then you bring the police into... ask someone from a pub because they haven't got a certificate saying they've got a vaccine. The world is literally going mad. I think we have to take a breath and calm down, because Dorset has got just over 1,200 police officers. That isn't very many. And we, you know, the police does not have the ability or the sustainability to police the way out of this. It's just wrong. And I do worry. I worry a lot about this summer, not just locally, but regionally. You've seen what's happening in Bristol. And there are various flashpoints in this country that we've seen historically many signs. South London, Manchester, Liverpool and Bristol have all sadly got the stamp of civil disorder on their history many times. And I fear that's what's going to happen.
Would you?
I know it sounds all very depressing, but you know, your listeners, hopefully your listeners know what I'm saying. It's a huge ask for a police force that polices by consent to police their way out of this. It really is a huge ask. And the European countries that are doing this don't have the same issue because they don't police by consent. They carry huge batons, they carry guns, they have water cannon that we don't have. You know, they police disorder, they police the public in such a different way that they frankly don't care about this. They're just doing their job and they'll go in and enforce it. It isn't how British policing works, and it's quite worrying.
I suppose you could say that are the police the kind of focal point for the public's frustrations at the moment?
Yeah, very much so. And if you look at what happened in Bristol last weekend, and the serious injuries that officers sustained, people are attacking the police almost as if, you know, vent their anger on society, take it out on the police, which of course is what happened in the Brixton riots and various other Tottenham riots and various other disorders, Toxteth. That is what happens. But you've got to remember that unlike Toxteth, Brixton and the others, this is a police force, just like the NHS, that is exhausted. This is a police force that's policed the COVID for a year. And this is an NHS that's policed a pandemic for a year. The NHS hasn't got much resilience left, and neither has policing. And to put policing into a summer-long period of civil disorder is deeply worrying because, you know, the police are tired. They've been doing this for a year.
Well, I think that's probably a good point on which to leave. How are you going to enjoy yourself in your retirement, or are you going to be worrying the whole time about the job you've left?
No, I won't worry about the job I've left. I've left my mark. I was the first ever police crime commissioner in Dorset. I was the first police crime commissioner nationally to commission a victim service. I'm very proud of my time here and I thoroughly enjoyed it. No, I won't be worrying, but I will be offering help to the new police crime commissioner. I will always be a listening ear because they are walking into untested times. They're walking into very unusual times. And I will, of course, if the phone rings, I will answer it and help. But no, I'm looking forward to a break, John, and finding another direction in my life.
Well, this reporter thanks you very much for, I think it's about the fourth or fifth interview we've done. And I think Dorset should be very grateful for the work that you've done. And thank you very much indeed for talking to me today.
Thank you, John.
Dr. Karen Kirkham is the clinical lead responsible for administering the COVID vaccine in our area. At the time we're talking to you, 80,000 people will have been vaccinated in Dorchester, Weymouth, Portland and the surrounding areas. To give you an idea of the numbers, 1,400 people a day have been vaccinated at one site alone, namely the Pavilion site in Weymouth. But not everyone who's been invited to have the jab is turning up, she tells us.
I'm talking to Dr. Karen Kirkham, and let's deal with the numbers first of all. How many people have been vaccinated in, say, the Dorchester, Weymouth and Portland area?
Good morning. So in total, I would estimate that we will have vaccinated approximately 68,000 people in the Weymouth, Portland and Dorchester area, and they are in the groups over 50. All of the patients will have been called during in all of those age groups. They've been vaccinated in the cohorts as it's been designed through the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation. So we started with the care home and most elderly residents and have increased and gone up the age ranges bit by bit until we're now into the final straight of trying to make sure that we vaccinate 100% of people over the age of 50. We're well on our way.
Very good. Now, where are these mass vaccinations taking place?
There are a number of vaccination centres around Dorset. There are 17 GP-led or primary care network vaccination sites in our local areas. In Dorchester, that takes place out of the Atrium Health Centre. And in Weymouth, there are two sites, one on the Malcolm Regis Day Hospital site, which is on the site of the Weymouth Community Hospital. And the second site we're using, because it's such a good site and has a lot of space, is the pavilion in Weymouth.
The pavilion site. How many people can you vaccinate there then?
So because it's such a good venue in terms of space and it has really good car parking and access, we are able to vaccinate per day from the pavilion around 1,400 people per day using a great number of vaccinator and admin staff and currently all of the brilliant volunteers who come and marshal people through. It means that we can operate. We have 11 pods running at any one time from the pavilion. We run from morning till night without a break. And that enables us to get through about 1,400 people in a day.
Can we just talk about no shows? I understand if you sort of read the national press and look at the national figures that, in fact, the number of no shows has increased. It was 2%. It now seems to be climbing towards 10%. Is that your experience?
Yes, we have found that. In fact, in the older age groups, particularly over the age of 70, got very, very small numbers of people who haven't come forward for the vaccine. Yes, in the order of just a few percent, 2 or 3%, who haven't come forward for the vaccine. As we've gone into slightly younger age groups, it has been a little bit more tricky to get everyone through the door in terms of accepting the vaccine. We'd really like to understand the reasons for that. So it does, it definitely, we have seen anything up to about a 10% rate of either not accepting or just being hesitant about accepting vaccination, and we'll do whatever we can to try and understand the reasons for that. Now, the best thing that we can do is ask people to contact their GPs and discuss their concerns, because often with reassurance, we can help people to try and make those decisions. But the other thing to say is, even if you haven't accepted a vaccine as yet, it's not too late. So we're not declining people. We're not saying you can never have it. We'd like to understand the reasons for not having it, and we'd like to see if we can help people make those decisions to take the vaccine, because it's so important to help you protect yourself against the effects of COVID-19 infection, which of course vary from, you know, an unpleasant illness to a life-threatening illness and even death. So we are absolutely trying to help people to make that decision if they can.
So if you do miss your slot, what should you do?
If you do miss your slot, just get in touch with your local GP surgery and say that you would like to have the vaccine, and we will be really happy to appoint you on the next vaccination clinic.
The advice is, if you haven't had your vaccination and you should have had it, then get in touch with your GP and get organised.
You are listening to Ridgeway Magazine on Keep 106.
Now, the topics in this edition of Ridgeway Magazine have been rather sombre. To brighten the mood, let's let in a ray of sunlight. Pubs particularly, restaurants, and I suspect any eating establishment with a garden, are considering the need for an outdoor area protected from the elements in which drinks and food can be served. Dorset Council is bending over backwards to give permits where they're required for outdoor seating arrangements in what it calls temporary structures. If you or your business has not already applied, Darren Rogers, the Planning Enforcement Officer, is the go-to man for information and help.
Now, I need some advice. I've got a pub, or maybe I'm a restaurant, and I've got a bit of land at the back of it, and I'd very much like to use it so that I can serve people in the summer outside. How do I go about that?
Well, thank you, John. We want to, obviously, as a council, support economic recovery and help local businesses to adapt to the current social distancing requirements. We obviously recognise that the last 12 months in particular has been a very challenging time for many businesses, and we want to support those businesses where we can, and we'll be taking a pragmatic approach to planning requirements to support businesses wherever possible. So what we've set up is a fast-track planning advice service for businesses, so that if there are businesses who are planning to make changes due to COVID-19 that may require planning permission, for example, changes to the use of your outdoor space or provision of temporary structures, marquees, etc., etc., we would ask that you contact us. We do have a website, but I'll just explain to you exactly what we do with your requests. First of all, we'll have a look at the proposals and confirm whether they're acceptable in principle. There's no charge for the service that we're currently providing, and we are aiming, because of the fast-tracked nature and the need for speed in this instance, we are aiming to get such requests back within 10 working days. What we ask for is obviously the name of the business, name and address, contact details of an individual if possible, a site location plan, obviously indicating where the current business is, and then a location plan that shows the location of any proposed temporary structure, details of its size, length, width and height, or any outside area that you're planning to use differently.
Can I ask a question at this point? What sort of drawing do you require? I mean, do you require a drawing from, say, an architect or anything like that, or can it just be a drawing, you know, with a sort of freehand drawing?
Yeah, a freehand drawing is fine. Anything that is able to kind of give us the sufficient information to understand exactly what's proposed and where, for obvious reasons.
So you need dimensions.
Sorry?
You need dimensions.
Dimensions, yeah, very much so. I mean, architect's drawings are, first of all, they're too costly for this particular service that we provide. But anything that gives us the ability to understand exactly what is proposed and where would be very useful. A description of whatever you're planning to erect. Details of when you plan to make those changes or when you start those changes, and any photographs that you can provide that indicate where any temporary structure, for example, will be located. So those are all the things that we need. What we then do is, once we've received your information, an officer will assess the proposals, we'll consider whether planning permission would technically be required, and consider whether there be any significant impacts on, for example, amenity and noise of neighbours, particularly given that if it's an outside venue, you could have late night drinking, for example. Highway safety issues, are you blocking footways or roads, or any other hindrance to services that might prevent deliveries, for example. What we also do is we consult building control, environmental health, licensing, and our highways colleagues, and we get responses back from them that then provide the ability for us to then send a letter back out to the person inquiring. Now, we are doing this pragmatic approach, particularly to planning enforcement, given the government's instructions to us, really, that we should be taking a pragmatic and a proportionate approach in order to help businesses to get back on their feet, given the significant impact that COVID-19 has had on many businesses. And we'll be reviewing this in December 2021. We brought this into play during lockdown one last year. We said we'd review it in December 2020, but given how far and how long COVID has gone on, we're now reviewing it in December 2021.
So let's just recap on that. I mean, how many permissions have you given then?
Well, it's not permissions. It's just a letter of advice that we've sent out. And I would say we've done, across the whole of the Dorset Council area, upwards of about 20, 25. So the numbers aren't particularly significant. But there's been lots of advice given to businesses where they've wanted to put chairs and tables on highways, and that's administered separately through our highway officers. But this is the planning response for temporary structures that are required in order to support the businesses going forward.
Do you suppose then that a lot of, we'll say pubs and restaurants, don't understand that they can apply to you? Because 25 doesn't seem very many. I mean, particularly when you think of Weymouth, which is very active.
So, no, I mean, we We've got the advice on our website, so if anybody wanted to just go into dorsetcouncil.gov.uk and type in Fast Track for Businesses, or even Google Dorset Council Fast Track for Businesses, you'll clearly get the link. And of course, doing something like this may mean that we get a number of inquiries from here on in. But the whole thing about the planning response is that even if people have put things up that technically should have needed planning permission, we are taking a pragmatic approach. But, of course, we will take planning enforcement action if we don't consider that what has taken place is particularly acceptable or is beginning to have harmful effects on, for example, neighbours' amenity and all manner of other things.
So when does a temporary structure become a permanent structure? I mean, I read that people, businesses are sort of constructing sort of things out of wood, which seem to be quite permanent.
Yeah, it all depends on the various tests. Anything that's effectively demountable and can be put up in a day is unlikely to trigger a formal planning permission proposal. So for example, many of the things that we're having at the moment are kind of decking areas that people want to erect. And it's all to do with the degree of permanency, fixation to the land, and how long these things are likely to be in existence. But things such as marquees, yes, we want to know about them, but marquees generally can be put up quite quickly in a day and technically wouldn't need permission in any event.
So basically, you're employing a light touch at this time. And
yes,
you review at the end of the year, do you? Because
yes,
in perhaps in 2022, you may be charging for something which is freely available this year.
Well, I mean, who knows? I mean, we didn't know where we would be in the last 2020. We didn't know how long COVID would last. It's obviously taking longer and, you know, will be something that I think that we will be living with. But, yeah, we'll be reviewing matters in December 2021. And, of course, we will be looking at whatever legislation is in place that the government indicate that we should do in and around that time as well.
Well, Darren, just give me that website again that anybody who is interested can apply to.
Yeah, it's a very long link, so all I'm going to suggest is if people were to Google dorsetcouncil.gov.uk and or Fast Track for Businesses, that should be able to get you to our website. It's entitled Our Approach to Planning Requirements, Coronavirus Update, Supporting Businesses and the Local Economy.
Well, there you have it, and thank you very much indeed for the explanation.
For the last 6 months or so, we've been telling listeners about local charities which need your support. It's refreshingly different to bring you news of an organisation that's seeking good causes to support financially. For the last 20 years, Blandford-based brewers Hall and Woodhouse have been opening what they call their community chest, and this year is no different as they invite local charities to apply for a generous handout. Retired Chairman Mark Woodhouse explains.
Mark Woodhouse, now tell me about the Community Chest Awards. I mean, anybody who plays Monopoly will be familiar with the phrase Community Chest, but what does it mean in your context?
Thank you. The Community Chest was something which we set up 19 years ago now, unbelievably. And basically, it's a pot of funds to help local voluntary organisations do the fantastic good that they do in our community. This year we'll be offering £50,000, which can be awarded to pretty much any voluntary organisation across our trading area. So that's really the south of England, except sort of Kent and Cornwall. And that can be for pretty much anything too. We're very aware that lots of good voluntary organisations have struggled with fundraising and are just basically going to need money for running costs. You know, and if we're going to keep a lot of these good voluntary organisations going, you know, then they need all the help that they can get.
Well, certainly on our radio station, we support local charities as far as we're able to by giving them a voice. Tell me,
What are the sort of people, charities, that you've been able to help over the last 19 years? Because you must have given away a considerable amount of money in that time.
We have, indeed. Yeah, I think we've had requests for over £5 million during that time, which is a bit awe-inspiring. But we actually have given over £650,000 to about 800 organisations. And people can apply for grants of between sort of £400 and £4,000, so it's small but not insignificant money, and we never cease to be amazed by how well voluntary organisations are at making a little bit go a long way. There's a lovely organisation called REMAP, which nobody knows what it stands for, but I think somebody described it as being retired engineers meaningfully applied, and they make all sorts of good things out of scrap, and they usually ask for about £400, and it's amazing what they can do with just very small amounts of money. I mean, we've helped the library at Puddletown, we've helped old people's organisations, Scouts, particularly we love supporting Scouts. There seem to be a never-ending request for tents and cooking equipment, which is great, anything to get young people out and about. But I think probably this year, I guess we're going to try and help those people who've been affected by, you know, the pandemic, you know, food banks and the like. So who are doing such a fabulous job, you know, trying to keep people going.
Yes, I was going to ask you about food banks because, of course, you know, a year ago, we weren't really au fait with what they were going to have to do in the forthcoming 12 months or so.
Yeah.
Where are the food banks that you help? Are they located throughout your area?
Yes, with some in Poole and some down in Sussex, because we trade right across to Eastbourne. But it was interesting because this time last year, of course, there was a lot of food from the liners, in Southampton and the like, you know, the Pool Food Bank was processing. So our pubs were able to use, they were able to use our refrigeration and freezer space in the pubs. And clearly we had a lot of food that needed to be used up before it went out of date. So prior to each lockdown, you know, we've made sure that the food has hopefully gone to, you know, the most deserving causes.
I mean, would it be right to say that food of that nature is now sort of drying up, if that's the right phrase, or is there still food available?
Well, I mean, I think clearly there is food available, but I think, you know, that particular windfall, if you like, was from as a result of the initial lockdown and the subsequent lockdown. And clearly the cruise ships haven't gone anywhere, but our pubs were open, you know, up to November, then December, for a month or so there was food, you know, and hopefully we've made sure that that's been allocated to, you know, worthy organisations, including, I have to say, our own team members, you know, who struggled somewhat. You know, the pub staff have had a very difficult time of it. You know, they were been furloughed more often than not during the last year, so it's been great to be able to help them as well.
I see. Can you think of any other charities, possibly rather unusual, I mean, you mentioned one, that have benefited?
Yes, but...
Probably a difficult question on the spur of the moment.
Off of my head. I mean, we've helped, one of the ones we love is Harbour Challenge down in Poole Harbour. They've always done really good stuff, you know, helping disadvantaged people get out on the water. And then there's Cherry Tree and Chestnut Nursery, who are Poole and Bournemouth, and don't ask me to quote you which is which, but they help people with learning disabilities to get into employment, and that's a fantastic organisation.
So basically, what we're saying is that the help that you give is across a very broad spectrum.
Yeah, it is. I mean, we've helped the Women's Refuge in Weymouth, for example, you know, and a group of sailors at the Sailing Academy. And on the Isle of Portland, too, we've helped Island Community Action, which is a local voluntary group that helps disadvantaged people. So, yeah, the Community Chest deals with... a very wide variety of voluntary organisations.
Well, I think the moment has come when I must tell people, A, how to get in touch with you, and also by what date applications have to be received, and where and how.
Yeah, that's all quite easy. It is if you've got a computer. We've now moved it all online, and thank goodness we did a couple of years ago, otherwise trying to run the community chest last year would have been extremely difficult with all the remote working. But yeah, if people who would like to apply, go to www.hall-woodhouse.co.uk/community-chest. There's all the information that anybody needs and an application form. And we're not asking for War and Peace, just a brief description of the organisation and what the money will be spent on. And applications have to be in for the 4th of May, so everyone's got plenty of time to get those applications in. And what the judges are looking for, you know, to help people understand what we're after, is, you know, is there a real need for what the organisation is asking for, or is it a nice to have? And I'm afraid we'll have to focus this year on, you know, the need particularly. The next thing that we're interested in is the money that we're going to give going to make a difference? What we don't want is money to be squirreled away in a bank account and not spent, you know, when it could be doing good elsewhere. And lastly, and by no means leastly, you know, what we're really interested in is organisations that help themselves, because they tend to be the ones that survive in the long term.
And all this has to be done. The closing date for applications is
4th of May, Friday the 4th of May.
Remember that closing date, Friday the 4th of May.
Keep 106, your local radio.
How does your garden grow? Well, John's is full of weeds, and I'm sure yours is too, and mine. So weeds and weeding is the focus of this edition's gardening topic. Ruth Hayes of Amateur Gardening magazine tackles the subject from brambles to ivy. But be kind to nettles, she tells John.
Hello, Ruth. Oh, the subject today is going to be weeds.
Good morning, John. Oh, we all have weeds, don't we?
And are they growing on the first day of summer?
I know. I mean, the trouble with weeds is, well, there's several troubles with weeds, obviously, but they're not all bad. But they grow faster than our cultivated plants. They're more vigorous. And at this time of year, we've had some rain, we've had some sunshine, and they are romping away. So they need tackling. Yes.
Now, is it a good thing to dig up every single weed that you can see?
No, personally, well, no, it isn't. I mean, weeds are basically wild plants growing in what we would call the wrong place in our gardens. But they are such an important part of the natural ecosystem because they provide, say, dandelions, that they come into flower early. They provide a really valuable food source for early queen bumblebees coming out of pollination. Nettles, for example, are food plants for the caterpillars of tortoiseshell and red admiral butterflies. There's another weed called wild garlic, which has little white flowers and almost nettle-shaped leaves, slightly rounder. And when you pull it up, it smells of oniony, has a very strong oniony, garlicky smell. And that is a very, very important food plant for orange-tip butterflies, which are getting rarer. So, I mean, if you can find room in your garden and in your heart to leave a few weeds about the place, the insects and wildlife will thank you.
But what about weeds in flower beds?
Weeds in flower beds, dig them out. There's various things you can do. I mean, yes, you could use a weed killer, but personally I prefer to dig them up. The thing with weeds in flower beds is if you dig up the really chunky perennial weeds, like your dandelions, your chickweed, your bindweed, which is an absolute nightmare to get rid of, if you can get all of that out, and by all of it, I mean get all the roots out as well, because if you leave even a half a centimetre, half an inch of weed in the ground, it will regenerate. But if you can get all these big perennial weeds out, after that, you don't actually need to do any digging. You can just hoe over over the surface of the soil, say once a week, once every 10 days. When you see the little weed seedlings just starting to appear, hoe over, cut them off, let them rot down, and that's it. It's a much, much easier way of keeping your borders weed-free.
So, big weeds bad, good weeds just...
little weeds, just hoe them off, let them go. Yeah.
Right. Now, I've had a question from a listener, actually. Rambles.
Yes, yeah, we have a massive problem with brambles in our front garden. And they're great because you get blackberries from them, but they are the very devil to get out. Because when they grow down, they put new roots, you know, from the tips of each shoot. So they can be really hard to get rid of. My advice would be to cut them down very carefully, wear long sleeve shirts, wear really sturdy gardening gloves, leather ones if you can. Cut them down, compost or take those bits you've cut to the green recycling centre. And then you can get a weed killer called SBK, which is really good for killing off old tree stumps, and it's great for brambles. And you just put a bit in a jam jar, get an old paintbrush, and very carefully dot it on the cut stems of the brambles, and that will kill them off.
So what's the name of that weed killer again?
It's called S for sugar, B for Bertie, K for kilo, SBK.
Another thing which is really bad in my garden, ivy.
Yeah.
I have got tons of ivy, and I think it's probably because in previous years the ivy has been allowed to grow up fences and up walls, and it's been cut back. And now I want to cultivate a part of the garden which really hasn't had much to care over the years, I would say. I'm faced with these roots, this root system, which is, well, when I say fibrous, I mean, I can't think of another word.
It's like a thick mattress of roots.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And they go down very deep as well.
Yes. I mean, the thing, if you've got the tips of the stems of your ivy plants, once you've cut them back above soil, again, you can use something like SBK or Roundup. Roundup is another systemic weed killer. You can sort of dab on the stems, and that will run down to the roots and kill them. If you haven't got the stems still sticking up above the ground, I'm afraid it's elbow grease.
Well, I'm taking a pickaxe to mine.
Yeah, yes.
No other way for it.
Yeah.
We're talking about weeds. There are some good weeds that you've mentioned, but having got them out, how do you sort of stop them from coming back?
Well, if you've got them all out, if you've got all the roots out and everything, they shouldn't come back. If you can get them before they've set seed, so they're not spreading themselves around, that's ideal. And I should say, if you're digging up weeds, if you're taking out weeds and they have got ripe seed heads in, don't put them in your compost, because the seeds will just stay there in the warmth for however long, and then when you spread your compost around the garden, they'll germinate and pop up again. But most weeds can just go on the compost. They shouldn't come back if you've got all the roots out of the big perennial weeds. Otherwise, just hoe them off and you should be okay.
Right. Oh, yes. Now, what about weeds in lawns? I'm confused because you read some gardening pundits and they say, don't mow your lawns. And you read other people. In fact, actually, I've read this advice in the same story by one well-known gardening guru, says only cut your lawn once a week, and then he says don't cut it at all.
Right.
What do you believe?
Right. Weeds in the lawn is just one of those things that you're going to get weeds in your lawn. You've got two ways you can go forward. You can use a lawn weed killer if you must. Don't use a general weed killer, because that will kill the grass as well. There's a company called Weedol, Weedol, that makes a specific lawn weed killer that will tackle the weeds but leave your grass alone. So you can use that, just paint it on the on the weeds, or you can buy weed pullers. Various companies make these sort of weed pullers, so you can individually pull up the bigger weeds like your dandelions, your creeping buttercup. They may leave a hole, a muddy hole, little muddy hole in your lawn, but if they do that, just sow some grass seed on top of it. That's a good time of year to do that now, and it'll come back. Can I just say one more thing, John, that people should be aware of? If you are using a weed killer on your weeds, be really careful, because it won't differentiate between your weeds and your cultivated plants and will kill them all. So never use it on a windy day, and just use it very sparingly.
Now let's turn our attention to Weymouth. It's hotels and B&Bs, of which there are about 170. We spoke to Claire Wall, who is the chair of the Weymouth Hotel and Guesthouse Leaseholders Association. About a third of B&Bs in the association are owned by Dorset Council, and talks about rental payments and rent holidays are still ongoing as business incomes have been decimated. But as Claire says, the big day is May the 17th, when they can all open for business. No one is sure of the rules yet, but it might mean dining rooms remain closed and breakfasts might, as happened last summer, have to be pre-packed and eaten by guests in their bedrooms. There is uncertainty about this, but she and her members hope that as the regulations are gradually relaxed, normal food service will be restored. But the good news is that her members are beginning to take bookings, as staycations will prove to be a replacement for overseas holidays. John sought the views of an independent guest house owner.
I'm talking to Lynn Fisher, who has the St John's Guest House in Weymouth in Malcolm Regis, isn't it?
It is, yes. The old Malcolm Regis, yes. Down by St John's Church, yep.
Right, now then, tell me, I mean, you've obviously, and everybody who's in the guest house and accommodation business in Weymouth and throughout the country, of course, has been blessed with the same problems, haven't you? I mean, what happened last year? Because there was a kind of false start. People started to book with you and to have holidays with you, and then it all stopped, didn't it?
So normally we find that January, February time, people start booking for mainly for Easter onwards. And of course that happened last year, but then once we got to March, we went into the pandemic around the world, and on the 23rd of March, so a year ago today, we went into lockdown. And anyone at that point that was then booked for Easter and for the Maybank holidays and the May holiday all had to cancel. So we were giving an awful lot of deposits back and or moving dates or holding deposits for people. It was a really, really difficult time, and it went on until the 7th of July, when we then thankfully reopened again.
But not for long, was it?
No, because, well, we had a good season, so we were open for July, August, September, October. Then we went back into lockdown again for November, which, I mean, traditionally in Weymouth is a fairly quiet time anyway, but it also then impacted on December again. And of course, we went back into lockdown again in January. I think the difference this year has been we didn't really know how long it would last. So I think people were bitten last time over it and were nervous about booking again in January. So traditionally, when we would have had people booking for the summer, for Easter, people haven't been doing for this year.
You must talk to other B&B operators, because you all know each other.
Yeah.
What's happening at the moment in Weymouth? I mean, are people booking?
So I think once Boris announced his roadmap earlier in the year, then it did warm up a little bit. People were sort of very tentatively then starting to book. And I know that, you know, we haven't been inundated by any means, but people are starting to put the feelers out and to make some bookings. And I think other guest house owners, B&B owners in Weymouth are feeling the same. We for one, are now starting to feel a trickle of bookings coming in from 17th of May onwards when we reopen. We're having a couple of bookings, probably a day, coming in now.
Are people being very, what's my word, conscious of the fact that there could be another lockdown in the future?
Yes. So anyone that's getting in touch direct, they're always asking, what are our T's and C's? What's our cancellation policy? And normally we would take the first night as a deposit, but we're playing things a little bit
differently this year, both for our benefit and for the benefit of the guests. And we're saying that we're not taking a deposit at the moment, and we won't take a deposit until May when we open and we know, you know, what the horizon's going to look like, really, and whether it will be safe to take deposits and holidays are likely.
So Weymouth is open for business?
It will be on May the 17th as far as staying overnight. I think it opens before then with some of the other restrictions around restaurants and the bars and pubs, but certainly for staying overnight in a B&B, May the 17th, yeah.
Well, that's good news.
Very.
Well, thank you very much indeed for talking to Ridgeway Magazine.
You're very welcome.
You may think I've nothing better to do than to talk rubbish. Apart from taking issue with Dorset Council's request not to take frivolous rubbish to the tip, although it's probably one of those well-intentioned remarks that came out all well or wrong, I did a rubbish survey of my own. And here comes the question. Why is it people carpet our paths with the sort of rubbish that comes from a consumer society that sees no harm in leaving a trail of garbage in its wake? I live between Broadway and Littlemoor and frequently take the path that has an elegantly designed bridge that takes you over the new relief road. The amount of rubbish on either side of the wide walkway is mind-boggling, especially visible now before the undergrowth, that's brambles and bushes, don't yet have their summer greenery. On a 15-minute walk, this is what I found. 5 face masks, several dozen food wrappers and plastic food trays, 187 drinks containers, of which 2/3 were cans, 3 plastic crates, quite large, dozens of sweet wrappers, milk and fruit juice cartons, pieces of paper too many to count, tool receipts, sweet wrappers and crisp packets, things like that, 3 sacks of DIY rubbish, lengths of plastic piping, some metal offcuts, and dog poo bags without number decorating the brambles. Conversely, there was a neatly cut grass area around the housing estate. The only litter there were pieces of paper in the gutter. Surprisingly, I found only 1 cigarette packet and 3 glass bottles on my walk. Now here's the question. Tended areas of grass invite no litter. So, if the council were to cut back the brambles by the side of the path, would the well-kept appearance of the area make folk think twice about littering? I only ask, and it's not a frivolous question.
Thank you, John. Well, once again, the clock has beaten us and we've got to go. Thanks for listening. From John Shepherd and me, Andy Venton, until the next edition of Ridgeway Magazine, cheerio.